Good morning, everybody. My name's Carla Moore, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to start by thanking Harlan for inviting me out here to share with you guys today. It's all of my friends who have been here have told me I was going to have a great time, and so far it's just beautiful. I want to thank the committee and everybody who had anything to do with putting on such a beautiful conference. It's nice to be able to participate in that this weekend, and thank you for that. And the best potluck, the best attended potluck I've ever seen last night. Oh my God, the line was out the door, and it's just good. That kind of enthusiasm shows us that the miracle has happened. You know, we're inside these doors, we're awake and alive and sharing with each other and having a good time doing it too, getting to stay sober and unmiserable for a while. I want to thank my fiancé, Doug, for coming with me this weekend. He's another miracle, and I almost missed him. He's nonviolent. He's got no recent prison experience, and he's perpetually joyful all the time. And not that he doesn't have moments, but he's just has an outlook on life that I had not seen that like that up close before. And so I almost missed him, almost walked right by. And we have a good time. So I want to thank you all for this opportunity. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't sure that I had no doubt that I had a huge problem. I had no doubt I was an alcoholic of a description I understood. I knew I wasn't controlling my drinking. I knew that I had big problems and alcohol had a lot to do with them. But I just wasn't sure that Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be the answer. I just couldn't see how these thinly veiled spiritual principles, 12 little sentences hanging on a wall, was going to have anything, any effect on my life in the face of what I had become. And I'm just so happy to report that since September 25th, 1987, I've not had to have anything to affect my emotions or my my outlook on life except these 12 sentences and principles and a fellowship as big as the world. So if you're new today, I want to let you know that this thing works, and it works good. When I got here, I would have told you I had a big story. If you had my family, you'd drink too. They were dark, dramatic, violent, perverted, and things happened in our family that should never have happened inside those walls. And we gave a whole different look to the world, to the outside world. But things were happening, and I didn't know how to talk about them. And a lot happened as a result of that. But I also, since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've met people who lived charmed childhoods. My fiancé, Doug, he lived a charmed childhood. He was the favorite. You know, he had three sisters, and they all loved him, and he had a successful career, and all kinds of things. And yet, when he picks up a drink, the drink takes him, and then he's gone. And then it's something about our inability to process alcohol makes me an alcoholic, you know. But I didn't know it was as simple as that, and I had all kinds of excuses and reasons and insanely trivial excuses for going back to picking up that first drink. And I don't want you to think it was all bad. I had a great time in elementary school. Fourth, fifth, and sixth grade were terrific. I was always the new kid on the block. We moved around a lot, and so I was always trying to find a way to fit in. And whether it was school politics or academics or sports or whatever it was, I needed to be first and on top and in charge and the best. And God, by the time sixth grade was over, I was tired and I needed a drink. And running the world when you're 10 is just a big, big job. And then I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. That summer between sixth and seventh grade, I was at my friend Leonard's house, and there were a few girls and a few boys, and we were spinning the bottle and passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey. Now, those weren't the first drinks I ever took, but they were the ones that started to really, really have a dramatic effect in my life, I wanted to do it often. So we spun the bottle, and the bottle landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. I don't even think they play that game these days. I think they just get right down to business, but we played back then. And when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut, and I did not think that was fair. And I still don't think it's fair, if you want to know the truth, but every sponsor I've ever had has told me the fair is in Pomona, and it lasts 2 weeks, and that's all you get. So fair's not really the issue. Back then, I was one of those kids. I just couldn't accept the things I couldn't change. I didn't know how to roll with the punches or how to learn the lessons of life on a day-to-day basis. It seemed to me that you were getting them and I wasn't, for whatever reason. And I got a reputation I couldn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for in junior high. And a reputation like I had goes through junior high like wildfire. Girls my age were looking at me funny, and boys my age were looking at me funny. And I did what I do when my feelings get hurt. My pride kicks in, and I start to back away from my life. And I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom, and hanging out with the other girls who were backing away from their lives. And I'd bring stuff from my mother's liquor cabinet and from her medicine cabinet, and we'd hang out. And I did that until it just didn't work anymore. And I stayed, and I fought until I couldn't fight anymore. And my gypsy heart took over. I'm a kid. I love to go. I still love to go, but I like to come home, too, and I have a home to come to, which is a big plus these days. But back then, I just started to run, and I could be found on the 10 freeway going east and the 101 freeway going north on the little on-ramps. I'd stick my thumb out, and I'd crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else, and I love that feeling. That was a feeling of hope for me. It just seemed like just around the corner or just up the road or just a couple days from now, things are going to get better. It felt like the bottle in the glove compartment, you know, that just any time now, things are going to be okay, and I love that feeling of hope. I go along way on that kind of hope, and consequently, because I was young, I started spending a little time in the California, Southern California hot spots like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and Central Juvenile Hall in LA, and in and out, and they'd send me home to mom or send me home to dad, and the more I would go out on the road, the less I was able to integrate myself back into my community. I certainly wasn't going to tell the right about where I'd been on my summer vacation, and those feelings of difference increased, and I just I used the solution that I knew. I drank, and when I was 14, I found myself in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area, where a couple of guys propositioned my friend and I. They offered us money for sex, and we said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us, and I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And it sort of seemed to me that the outsides were starting to match the insides. It seemed to me that more people were out there doing what I was doing than they were back home. And it just seemed like I fit more on the outside than I did back home. And I ran until I couldn't run anymore. And when I was 15, the court took over, and I was admitted to a mental hospital. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks, and I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved in. And they weren't talking to me a lot about alcoholism then. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child. I was alternately violent and withdrawn. And I was living with a level of frustration down in my gut that I've not had to experience in a very, very long time. But I, like I said, I didn't know how to talk to you about what had been going on. I didn't know how to be. I didn't know how to be in my own skin. And I heard it described once as being like a scream without a mouth. And that's how I felt. So they were treating me with daily nutritional supplements of Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmain sleepers. I suppose they were afraid I wouldn't sleep. And I became intimately familiar with five-point restraints. And that's what I looked like when I was 15. I like to talk about the Nut House because it just really, really characterizes my thinking starting from then and well up into the time that I got sober. And so I have a little fun talking about this. If you don't want to go crazy in the Nut House, you got to get busy. One of my favorite ways to be busy, I've already told you, was boys. I love all the boys. But my favorites are those sexy, smoldering types. You know the kind. They're just sitting back there simmering. I can see some of the smoke coming out in this room this morning. And I found them very exciting. You know, you just never know when guys like that are going to blow. And when they do, man, look out. But guys like that are always getting hauled off from the Nut House. You know, they're in there on some kind of grace. They're getting away from their punitive sentences, and they'll do something stupid. They eventually blow, and they get hauled off to YA, for California Youth Authority, for Well, like my first boyfriend got hauled off for throwing a chair through the window, and my next boyfriend was hauled off for throwing a nurse through the window, so that was progressive too. And back then, when you're locked up, they were playing some of those real romantic old songs, old love songs, like, "Oh, when will I see you again?" And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life, you know, music playing in the background of all this sweet agony that's going on. And I remember one afternoon I was sitting outside the girls' unit on the smoke break bench. I was watching my boyfriend Terry across the way being cuffed and escorted off by security. He's the one who threw the chair through the window, and he's gone. He's on his way out. And I'm just smoking my tragic cigarettes and watching this whole ordeal go on. And just inside the girls' unit, I can hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch me in the morning, then just walk away." It took me a long time to realize I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. You know, it's what goes on between my ears. It's the way I see my life. I'm just always looking at a little bit crooked. And when I'm looking out, I'm always about half a bubble off what it is I think I'm looking at anyway. You know, I mistake arrogance for confidence. I mistake sex for love. I mistook brute strength for strength of character. And I get it up close. I get it up in my life, and it turns to dust because it's not real. It's counterfeit. And I get it up close, and I'm disappointed one more time. And it took all these years and coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that it's when I give of myself that gaping hole in my soul gets smaller. It's never going to come from out there. And even if it does, even if it was the right thing, there's never going to be enough if I got to wait for you to give it to me. But I had to come here to learn that. And all the while I was in that nut house, alcohol was still on my mind. I'm either drinking or thinking about drinking. When I've got no sufficient substitute, I've got no steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, I've got nothing else to trust but the effect that alcohol has on me. So even inside, I'm waiting to party. And every now and then, I'd find my way out of that nut house. Sometimes I'd find my way under the gate or over the fence, and you got to wait and time it just right, and it takes up some of your time planning all that stuff. I don't know whose bright idea it was, but sometimes they'd walk us right through the front lobby into parent group, and I'd put my street clothes on under my pajamas, and just when the time was right, you know, you just make a run for it. And sometimes you get there, sometimes you make it, and sometimes you don't, and it's just always worth a shot. But I'd stay out for a week or two, and then I'd come back in the front door of that nut house because it was my home. That's where I live. I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the Ward D, or the intensive care unit, if you will. It's the place they put all the patients that they didn't know what to do with. And like I said, they weren't talking to me a lot about alcoholism, and I didn't see a lot of mirrors for who I was. It was not a treatment center. It was a mental hospital. So there were people in there who had some real other diseases. There were some real schizophrenics. There were real manic depressives. There were real people with some other things. And so I just didn't get, I couldn't tell by looking out who I was or what was going on. And I had somewhere along the line kind of secretly surrendered to the fact that maybe I'm always going to be inside. Maybe I'll get the grace of being outside for just a little while, but I'll always be back into one of these places. And I certainly didn't know how to live. So I end up on this unit, and I had some strange roommates, and I met the love of my life on this unit. He was admitted one morning, early in the morning, around 7 or 7:30, and it finally occurred to me that there had to be something wrong with him, too. Well, he's in the nut house, first of all. That's a clue, but he came in, and I was sitting on the day room couch by then. I didn't sleep much, and I was no longer dressing or bathing, because you don't have to do that to date in the nut house, and I had casts on both my arms up to my shoulders because I'd been cutting. It's just a whole other way to, a warped way to change my reality. And I was sitting there and smoking my cigarettes as like a little princess. And he looked across the room and said, "Her, I just got to have her." And so it took a long time for it to register. There had to be something wrong with him, too. But I ended up going over the wall with him for the last time. And we lasted about 2.5 weeks. And he just didn't know what he was getting. I was 16, he was 22, I was coming off Thorazine, and I think it was just too much of a contrast for him, and he didn't really know what he was getting. And oddly enough, it took about 2.5 weeks for my probation officer to know exactly where I was, and it hurt my feelings later on when I realized I think he'd called her Come get her. She's right here. And into a rehab and into juvenile hall and always sitting in front of a judge waiting for placement. You might as well have stamped it on my forehead, just waiting for the next place and hoping maybe. I mean, inside I really had some kind of wish that things would be different, but I had only old tools, old ideas, and those survival skills that I was using. And I ended up in a girl's home when I was 17. That was the last place I went. And, you know, it's not like I didn't ever believe in God. I've always acknowledged the existence of God. I have felt the presence of God before I ever got a resentment, before I ever took a drink. When I was a very young kid, I felt the presence of God. But I never knew how to tap into, establish, and maintain any kind of relationship with that God. And I would try. I tried heavily. I was born into a Southern Baptist home, and my mother was really, really trusted that whole religion, and for a little while, I would go out in front of the bowling alley and hand out tracts, you know, you're going to die, that kind of thing, and that preacher used to come and visit me in juvenile hall, and I'd find God in juvenile hall and then leave him there when I left, and then I got that wholesale resentment that they talk about in the big book when we were at the bowling alley one time with some kind of church group thing, and the preacher's son asked me if I wanted to go out in the parking lot and smoke a joint, and I thought, ha, there's one for our side. So that I gave up on that. And when I was in, I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in fourth grade. And I love the ceremony of all of that. But like I said, it was all about what I could see. And today it's more about what I can't see than anything. But I tried praying to the other guy for a while, burning black candles, and trying to hedge my bets a little, really. I just want to be on the side that's winning, that's all. When I was in the sixth grade, the television series Kung Fu came out. Some of you might remember that show when David Carradine was a star, and he played a Buddhist priest who walked the Wild West in bare feet. That impressed me, and he could change your life in three words. You know, he just pearls of wisdom rolled off his tongue, and besides that, when they messed with him, he kicked their ass. You know, I just love that idea of strength and serenity that he carried around. So I got that, and that's what I wanted what he had, And then the idea of what might have happened in the 60s. You know, I was a big protester in my family. I identified with that standing up for what you believe in, and it seemed like they did all that in the 60s. Now, I was 12 in 1969, so the 60s were almost over by the time I got out in the world. But I carried that idea with me. There was a Grateful Dead and Crosby, Stills, and Nash and all of those people who just sang the songs of my heart. And so I had this idea, and I'm in this girl's home when I'm 17. I meet my roommate, and she's talking about it too. We're reading books like Be Here Now and trying to figure out exactly what that means. And all of our friends said, you know, you'll find that in Oregon. All of those people went to Oregon. And so we came up to Oregon where God might be, and we went out the second story window of that girl's home and jumped in Randy's truck and went up to Eugene, came up to Eugene, Springfield area. And they rented a little house and let me come with them. I thought what life was going to change from the outside in. We planted a garden in the front yard. And that's when I learned that in Springfield there, when they talk about hoeing, they mean with a garden tool. It's just a whole different way of talking. And I thought life was going to change from the outside in. And two things happened that I could see looking back. I certainly couldn't see them when they were happening. And our book talks about many of us showing signs and symptoms of alcoholism long before we're ready, willing, and able to do anything about them. And two things happened. One, I wasn't doing what I'd been doing to make a living, so I couldn't always drink the way I needed to drink. I'm a terrible thief, and I wasn't willing to risk that to go back to being locked up. So we couldn't always drink the way I needed to drink. And when I've got no booze and I've got no sufficient substitute, I've got no steps, fellowship, God and my understanding, I am restless, irritable, and discontent, and very, very hard to get along with. And when I can drink the way that I need to drink, I am always overshooting the mark. And that was happening to me still and again at 17 years old. And if you're doing that and you're sleeping on your friend's couch, a lot of you know this, that your friends are going to look at you one day and say something like, Carla, we love you, but you got to go. And that was to happen a lot. And I ended up in a roundabout way back down to my father's house in L.A., and he let me come home, and I hadn't been home in a long, long time, and And every morning we'd both get up, and he'd go off to work, and I'd go into the den, and I'd drink from his liquor cabinet. And I don't know why he had a full liquor cabinet. He was scared to death of alcohol and alcoholism. Alcoholism runs through my family like the Colorado River, and he had a violently, violently alcoholic father, and yet he's got a full liquor cabinet, and I figured it must be there for me. And he'd leave for work every day, and he'd come home, and he'd see me sitting in the same spot in the den on his couch drinking his booze, and he'd look at me with those broken-hearted eyes. And after a few months, he had to ask me to leave. He came to me right before my 18th birthday, and he said what I know were the hardest words he ever had to say to his oldest daughter, and that's, "I'm not going to watch you die, and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go." And I knew that day was coming. I always know that day's coming. I just try to milk it for as long as I can. And on my way out the door, all I could remember was that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And I know today I must have misunderstood, but I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard. And there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I can promise you that. And I was 18 years old, starting my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party, and some days it was just surviving. And every now and then, you know, you get rolled out of one of those little cars, and you fall down, you get up, you take a drink, and you keep walking. And there was not a lot of hope about it getting any different. And alcohol was absolutely saving my life and saving my sanity. A few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name. And 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name. But I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my 8-step list. He was someone I knew. He just came to mind. I just knew it. I knew I had, in 6 weeks, I had gone through his life quickly, cleanly, and ruined him materially, spiritually, physically, mentally, in every way I could. And he'd been nothing but kind to me. And I knew I owed him amends. So I spent the latter part of my first year of sobriety looking for him. And I went everywhere I knew to look, but like I said, I didn't know his last name, so I had to stop at some point. My sponsor said, "You're just going to have to set that down for a while. You're going to have to just work on yourself, do the things you know to do now, and if you're supposed to find that guy later on, you will." And she said, "You know, do change a few things now, like try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there?" And it was a great start. All these years later, I have friends of both genders. I know how to be a friend. I know how to have a friend. And it started there. And then right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town. And it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. And I went out and I gave that talk. And of course I felt better. You guys taught me how to show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and showing up's one of my favorite things to do, because I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really, you know? And so I like to show up and find out what's actually going to happen instead of what happens in my head. And so I went and I gave the talk, and when the thank you line came through at the end of the meeting, this man stopped and he said, "Where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety and I with almost 13. Now, only a very well-organized, loving God could have made that happen when I and all my efforts to get that done in my first year of sobriety couldn't get it done. And I like to tell that story because it reminds me that God's timing is always perfect, even when I don't think it's happening fast enough. And so I got to make those direct amends to that guy, and he said, "Oh, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive." And, you know, he's right. You know, the title of this conference this weekend is The Age of Miracles, and you know, if we're in this room this morning, we're the lucky ones. The miracle has occurred, and now it's up to us to do the footwork required to stay, and that's it. And that was a long time to come, that talk I got to have with that guy at 13 years of sobriety. And I spent the rest of that year in Hollywood, and then I hooked up with another guy from another rehab. And, you know, the rehabs are full of boyfriends, if that's what you're looking for. And we hooked up, and we're both loving the idea of peace and love still, peace, love, flowers, all of that stuff. And yet we couldn't stop really knocking the hell out of each other long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love in our own relationship. But we hit the rowdy road, and again, soundtrack rolling in my life. We're going up and down the California coast, beating each other to death and hitchhiking all around. And Bob Dylan and Jackson Browne playing in the background of my head. And we found we moved into a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon, just outside Williams. And and till the rains came. And then we met a guy living just north of Grants Pass up in a, he was living in a clear plastic tent, and he offered up his, us his roofless cabin. It was an old mining claim, and we moved in there, and we threw a plastic tarp over the top of that and called it a skylight and moved into that for a little while. And then the baby came, and all the while we're drinking herbal, natural wines and homemade beer and homemade moonshine because it's just so much better for you. And I had always sworn I was never going to be the kind of parent I had had. I was never going to put my hands on my child the way that my mother and stepfather had done to me. And you know, when you got no tools and only bad ideas, it just doesn't happen. And she got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old. He and I were fighting, and she almost got hurt pretty bad. And I took her up to Idaho, where it's got to be better somewhere else. It's just going to be better up there, on the way, on the road. And I moved up to Idaho, and I have three jobs up there. I'm tending bar and cocktail waitressing, and any normal person could have made a great living doing what I was doing, and I still couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time. And I lived off the, we lived in those rent-by-the-week motels up there, and my daughter's one of those kids that you see in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because her mom's not paying attention. And after a while, of course, Idaho's not working for us anymore. I'm drinking straight scotch. I'm not mixing it with anything anymore because, you know, those mixers give you a hell of a hangover. So you just really, I don't, and we've got to leave. We've got to leave Idaho now one more time because it's not working. And we're back down in L.A. I'm renting a room for my aunt in Covina, and I've got a job in Hollywood tending bar. My daughter's almost 4 years old by then. And every afternoon I'd leave her, and I'd take off for that bar in Hollywood, and I'd drink and pour drinks till the wee hours of the morning and crawl back home and start all over again. And on my way out to that bar, there was a halfway point called, there was a little bar in Arcadia called the First Cabin, and I'd stop there to have my primer drinks, those shots of Cuervo Gold and Budweiser backs that got me all ready and primed up to go out and do my shift in Hollywood. So every day it was the same routine, kiss the girl, go on out to Arcadia, and then on out to Hollywood to do my work. And one afternoon, I kissed my girl goodbye as I had done months on end, and I stopped in that same bar in Arcadia and had those same shots of gold and same bud backs, and something was just a little bit different on that day than it was than things had been the day before. I mean, I didn't hate that job in Hollywood, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool, and I drank those shots, and I drank those beers, and I couldn't suspend my drinking long enough to get up and go take care of business in either direction. I sat on that bar stool, and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I sat on that bar stool, and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia for about a month there. And every evening, I'd come back into that particular bar. I'd go all up and down the block and drink all day, and then I'd come back in about midnight, and the booze would be wearing off, and the chatter would be rising in my head, and my guts would be wrenching, and my throat would be closing, and I'd hear the band playing, and I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt you could walk my daughter up to me and say, you know, you can have her back if you'll stop drinking. And as much as I love that girl, you know, alcoholism does not care who I love. And as much as I loved her, I knew that alcohol had become my priority. And I couldn't have told you in those words, but I knew that she was far better off where she was. And I had to stop calling her to find out where she was, because she was asking me, or how she was, and she was asking me hard questions like, Mommy, when are you coming to get me? And I had no idea, no clue. I just knew she was better off where she was. And I fell into another job at another dive bar, and I thought maybe getting married was going to be the answer to my question, you know, maybe, or to my problem. Maybe if I made my life look like yours, maybe if we got married and we moved into a little apartment and I got to take care of the house and got the kid back and took care of his kids, maybe this would be the answer. And so he and I got married about the time we should have split up, and we moved in together, and we became an active household, and I threw the first punch in that relationship because I think I know the drill. I see him coming toward me, and I just know I better give him my best right cross. We bought ourselves a big gun to protect ourselves from the night stalker, and the only people we turned that gun on was each other. I just tried to get to it first. It just seemed to level the playing field a little bit. And my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was after one of our fights. We were at the bar where we drank, and we were fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool, and I lost that fight, and I ended up with some black eyes and broken ribs and nobody feeling sorry for me in that bar, just glad I was leaving. And my husband had to pick me up and take me to the hospital that afternoon, and I can't tell you the amount of times that my husband had to try to save my life and kill me all at the same time, and I've always got him at cross purposes. And He got me to the hospital, and he took me home. And before he left for work that weekend, he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin chilling on top. And now I'm drinking gin because tequila had been making me so mean. You understand, right? And I started drinking and dialing. And I don't know all of who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman, so I called a battered woman shelter, and I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life. And she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting. And I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. And I found an AA meeting not far from where I lived. And I went in there that night. And the one thing that I didn't go there with was readiness. It's the one thing you can't give me. It's the one thing that has to come up and through me. Not of me, but it comes from somewhere. And you can't make me ready. You can't make me do these things. And I went in there that night, and two very kind women sat me down and gave me the newcomer packet, a cup of coffee and a tissue. And I was sitting there feeling very sorry for myself, and I heard a woman speaker that night, just like you're listening to this morning. And I don't know all of what she said, but I know that I heard her say that somewhere during her drinking career she switched to beer, so I did. I left that meeting thinking, AA says switch to beer. And sometimes I'm glad I hear what I hear, even when they don't say it. But that time, I'm pretty sure she didn't say that. And but beer allowed me to last for another couple of years. It gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. It was rather soothing to my body, and I was getting very, very tired. I'm almost 6 feet tall. I weighed 110 pounds, and I just felt like if he blew on me, I'd turn to dust. And I lasted another couple of years. And we were evicted from that apartment and ended up living in a little room in his ex-wife's backyard. None of us liked that very much. And I got a little alcoholic willpower together, a little human willpower, and found a job answering phones for the city of Pasadena down there. And then I spent the next year in a whole other kind of torture where, with no sufficient substitute for booze, I am either drinking or thinking about drinking, and in some kind of alcoholic torture I hope I never have to experience again. I would try to get up in the morning and go to that job because in my mind I appreciated that job. I really, really did. I couldn't act like I did, but I thought I did. And I would try to make it there with no booze to stop the shakes in the morning. And when I would, it would be all I could think about was that next drink. And so I'm either drinking or thinking about drinking all through my day, and that lasted a year. And our relationship culminated one Saturday afternoon with the cops in the driveway and the neighbors peeking out the window wondering what's going on at Charlie and Carla's house one more time. The neighbors, the kids standing in the corner in her mismatched clothes and her unkempt hair, and she's got that look of fear in her eyes one more time, and I can't change anything about what's going on. I can't even see that I have a part in it. My husband left, the cops left, everybody's gone for the last time. They took the gun, and it's me and the kid and the booze, and we're sitting in this little apartment. And now financially, I was in a little better spot than I'd been in a very long time. And we were living indoors, and I had a little car, and I had a little job even. I'm hanging on to it by a thread, but I'm a little better off than where I'd been, and yet I'm dying of alcoholism more than ever. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to effect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, that I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard that whole fight go down. And a couple days later, she knocked on my door and she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12. And she sat on my couch and she told me her story. And in her story, I could tell that she used to drink like me. And over the last year, I'd seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what impressed me more about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking, and that got my attention, you know? Because untreated, without some steps or fellowship or some sufficient substitute, I feel like you've stripped the coating off my wires. I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And it gets worse from there, and eventually I got to come back to the very thing that takes me away, and that's a drink. Even with all the trouble that I know it caused, I still trust the solution. So I'm not sure, again, that her little solution is going to have any effect on me. And I'm thinking back to the days of the nut house, to the things that they had to give me to keep me calm and in any kind of state, reasonable state. And so I'm just not sure that this is going to be something that's going to work for me. Just another one of those little programs, just another one of those things. And so she left. And on her way out the door, she stopped and she asked me, she said, Carla, do you have trouble accepting life on life's terms? Do you think maybe that's... And I said, absolutely not. Life sucks, and I fully understand that. And It was about a week and a half later. I just didn't go back and buy any more beer. And exactly what I thought was going to happen happened. I got sick, and I started to shake. And I shook into the afternoon and shook into the night. And I saw and heard things that weren't there. And I shook into Monday, and I shook into Tuesday. And by Tuesday afternoon, I did something different. I went to my neighbor instead of the store, and I asked her what to do. And she sent me up to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous up in Sierra Madre, and that became my home group. I went up there, and she said, not that there'll be any big question, but raise your hand and tell them that you're new. And I said, okay. And I did. I went up there, and I sat way back by the exit sign just in case what, I don't know. But I sat in there, and I know I heard hope. I know I felt that relief, that unseen relief, that somehow that spirit, that thing that comes on in the room. When I get in these rooms, and I just hear everybody talking and nobody listening and all that stuff that goes on in here and people reaching out. The secretary did something very nice for me at the end of that meeting that night. She brought me back. In Southern California, at the end of a meeting, we'll read a portion of Chapter 11, A Vision for You, and then we say a prayer and close out the meeting. And she asked me if I wanted to read this time, and I said yes. I took it from her, and I said yes. And God, saying yes in Alcoholics Anonymous is the very best thing I can do even still. Yes is still the best answer at 22-plus years of sobriety. You know, setting up chairs, when I'm setting up chairs or making coffee or tearing them down or shaking hands or listening to you or picking up that newcomer or getting them a cup of coffee, find somebody who looks more uncomfortable than you feel and go help them. And it keeps me in a posture of hearing and delivering the message. It just keeps me in the middle of you. And some days my spirit and my head and nothing can catch up, and all I can do is get into the room. And when I do, I never know while I'm setting up chairs who's going to be walking by me that's going to say that one little morsel that sets me right for the next 24 hours. And I never know who's walking behind me who's going to watch and say, you know, maybe if Carla can do it, I can too. And day by day by day, we stay sober till midnight and we get to try again. And there's a lot of support for that. And I walked out of that meeting that night with a little bit of hope. And I got a sponsor very early on. And the only requirement I had for a sponsor was the fact that woman had not had 12 years, that had a drink in 12 years. And she was 52 years old, which is my age now. And I looked at her and I thought, well, her life is over. What else does she have to do? Oh, God. I want to go back and buy all the sponsors I've ever had flowers. I couldn't even possibly have appreciated what they gave to me. My appreciation continues to grow. So I got those commitments, and I had to drink one more time at 89 days. I just couldn't get from bridge to shore there. That first step edge came to me, and I just thought a big book and a beer sounded a lot more like balance to me, and maybe I'm just going to be one of those. And as soon as I took that drink, I knew I had to have another, but I knew also in that moment that I wanted back what I had just had a few minutes before, and I was willing to do the work. And now I had to finish that drunk, and then my sponsor picked me up the next day, and I finished the beers at my kitchen table, and she helped me throw out the bottles. My daughter was sitting there. We got a babysitter, and my sponsor took me up to the big book study, the Friday night big book study there that night. And they didn't even wait till I got sober. They just saw me, and I was not in great shape. And someone asked me if I wanted to come up Tuesday night with them and make coffee. And I thought, geez, somebody thinks I'm going to be here on Tuesday. And I liked that. And they let me sit in there. They didn't care that I was not sober. And day by day, you know, I would take something out of the meeting, every meeting that I would sit in, and I'd take it out into the day. And they'd say things like, go out there and try to do something for somebody and not get caught. And that'll keep a self-centered somebody like me very, very busy between meetings. And until the steps could take, I was just very, very busy physically and in the rooms. I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day. I needed to stay near you. And I was going to that job, and things were getting better. I was starting to pay rent for more than a month in a row, and we were, some things from the outside were getting better. And I started to work the steps with my sponsor, the obsession to drink, that terrible, terrible obsession. Some people would come in early on and it would just about kill me. They'd say, oh, the obsession has been lifted. And they were 6 days sober. And I would think, oh, God, you know, good for you. every single day for about 9 months of my sobriety till I was well into my amends. It was, am I going to drink today? Am I going to drink? Am I not going to drink? Am I going to drink? Am I going to drink? Am I not going to drink? And sometimes those panic attacks and anxiety attacks would come over me. And I learned how to sit still and sit on my hands at work until they passed. And I learned that they do pass. And I learned that looking back, that what those things were for me was just me surrounded with me. I was so consumed with my own self, and my own self is powerful. And what I didn't realize about alcoholism is that alcoholism is so powerful that it's not just some passing fad or disease. That it has the power to ruin lives. It has the power to kill. And Alcoholics Anonymous is just more powerful when I give my whole self over every day. I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day, and I made that first round of amends to my family, and my family required a lot of follow-up. I had followed up for years, breaking their hearts, and it was time for me to follow up whatever they needed. And none of us really knew if this was going to work or not. None of us were confident, but we were hoping. We were hopeful. And there's still, to this day, there's not one member of my family who would stand in the doorway and say, Carla, no, please don't go to the meeting tonight. You know, they're just all, yeah, we'll see you when you get back. That's good. After about a year, some other women were asking me to sponsor them, and I'll tell you, the only thing I like better than my fifth step is yours. There's a whole different kind of forgiveness that happens for myself and for you when I see the innocence of you come out. I can see that's in me too. When I look at you, when I look at the light coming on in you, I see that maybe there's hope for me. And I, even though I feel it on the inside, that's a visual. That's a living visual for me. And I love to sponsor women. I love to just help. If someone asks me for help, I just go do it. I've stopped trying to run their lives a little bit more, and I've become a little less judgmental and hopefully a little more merciful. But that's still daily practice. And after a couple of years, I had you guys, but my daughter didn't have anybody. And she was starting to come home at night. She was 12 years old, come home at all hours, beat up and bloody. And she'd been jumped into a gang and starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I did. And I was getting worried for her. She was in big trouble, and she didn't have any outside support. So it was me. I had the help of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, and then I had to give her big help. We had to go to a treatment center, and all of that stuff happened in one of those very, very mysterious ways, you know, just taking the next step. And always in Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever happens in my life today that I used to think would drive me out drives me further in. And I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous when things are going the way I like them and when things are going the way I don't like them. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have to let it drive me in. So I took her to a treatment center. I had to lie to her to get her there, and I was worried a little bit that maybe I was signing her life away the way that I felt like my life had been signed away. My father used to say that they were just trying to buy me some time. They're just trying to buy you some time, Carla. And I knew what he meant there when I'm signing my daughter into this treatment center. And by now it's a treatment center. And they had a program for kids, not just alcoholic kids or drug addicts, but they had a thing for kids because the gang influence was so big back then. And I don't know if it still is in the same way, but they were trying this out. And I was sitting there, and I'm signing the papers, and I feel a hand on my shoulder, and I look up, and it's a guy from my home group who works there. He's a recreational therapist there, and I knew that she was going to be okay. And I looked over across the room, and down the hall came another guy who used to work at a different adolescent program where I used to go pick up young girls and take them out to meetings. And it occurred to me that someone was going to be doing that to my daughter now. And you just never know. And Billy was saying this morning that God's the one who sees around the corners, And I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't pick up those girls in the adolescent unit because I thought my daughter might need help one day. I picked up those girls because I needed the help that day. And so all of this is unfolding, and it was for me to start those long amends. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time, and today I got to give my best spoonful every day. And I'd go show up at that place when they asked me to, and we'd do that therapy that they asked me to, and I was not big on that, but I knew we needed the help. And And I had become the very parent that I never wanted to be, and I had to see that in myself in order to get help. And I had to come in here and I had to tell you guys that I was treating my daughter the same way that I'd been treated, and that I didn't know how to stop. And it took me some time to come into Alcoholics Anonymous, to come in here and to work the solutions that you guys gave me to change as a mother. I learned how to be a mother in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she got out of that place after about 6 months, and she wanted to go live with her dad after a while. And we were getting better together, but she just wanted to go see what that was like. And it was for me to step back and let her go do that. And in the meantime, I was getting better jobs. I was showing up at these places and doing what they asked me to do. And I was I started out as a secretary, and I ended up getting my stockbroker's license and some other, and ended up in management in that industry after about 20 years, and then ended up leaving. But in the meantime, I'm just doing what you guys taught me to do. And I had to, page 19 says, a more important demonstration of our principles happens in our homes, occupations, and affairs. And I had to stop going to 2 and 3 meetings a day, and not to stop going to meetings, period, but I had to go to 1 meeting a day and then come home and be a mother to my daughter. I couldn't leave it for someone else to do. I was her mom, and that was for me to do. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools to do that. While she was gone living with her father, I continued to work, and I continued Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came home from the gym one night, and I went to bed, and I'm a little over 5 years sober. And I woke up in the middle of the night to a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth. And he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back, and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my bed. And I want to tell you that by 5 years of sobriety, I had a God that I trusted. I knew that things were not always going to end up the way that I wanted them to, but things were going to end up the way they were supposed to, and that I could trust that things were going to happen exactly like they were going to happen that night. And I no longer had that immature God that exists when things don't go my way and doesn't exist when things don't go my way. And it wasn't like I wasn't afraid. I mean, fight or flight kicked in. But I just knew there was a capacity to watch and see. And I said a little prayer for my daughter that if she had to hear some bad news about her mom, that she that someone be there with her. And it was only Alcoholics Anonymous that would give me the presence of mind and the peace of soul to be able to say a prayer at a time like that. And so it was those little things that I've been grateful for. And in the meantime, there's a man on my back in the middle of my room in the middle of the night, and I don't know how this is going to go, but after a couple of hours at a strategic moment, we got into a little tussle. And then I ran for the door, and I couldn't get out the front door because of the bolt lock. And we had a little fight, and it lasted a couple more hours. And then he ended up going out the kitchen window the same way he came in. And it turned out that I had known this guy. I'd watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I'd known him before any of us got sober. And I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back. And then I watched him join the church, leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I choose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my disease. This is where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. I practice these principles, and I acknowledge the terms and conditions of my disease, and then I can go anywhere I want to and worship, or nowhere. I like to read from a lot of different spiritual teachings, and I particularly connect with the ones that are based on the fundamentals of love and service. Those are the ones I get. There was a trial that followed, and my sponsor told me I was going to have to forgive this guy, and I know she's right. I know that at 5 years of sobriety, we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments, but the guy had scared me. And when I get scared, and at 5 years of sobriety especially, I get mad. Anger is my favorite. It was always my favorite place to go. It just makes me feel focused and like I've got a purpose. And yet, at 5 years of sobriety, it's like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. I can't be angry, and I can't not be angry. And that seven-step prayer became my mantra. I needed to find a chink in my armor. I needed to ask God to find the chink in my armor so I could start to let this go, because I was scared and tight and couldn't function on all 8 burners, on all 8 cylinders, that way. And I'd stand on the street, and I'd hear a car door slam, and I'd jump, and I'd get pissed all over again. And like I said, there was a trial that followed, and they found him under some strange circumstances. He'd been out causing trouble in a lot of different areas. And so as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I had known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be in the bars. And, and such, and including my ex-husband, and that's the mark I left on him, was the fact that he was more inclined to testify on behalf of a rapist than he was for me. And I've never been, he's never been interested in any amends I might have to make, but then we had to get someone to get up and testify as to my character at 5 years of sobriety. And by then I was working in this big trust company, this big investment firm downtown Los Angeles. It's a place I never even would have walked in the doors of years before. And yet I'm there. And he gets up and he testifies, and they told him all about who I used to be in the bars. And, you know, it was just never my intent, not always my intention, to walk into the bar and sleep with everybody sitting there that morning. It was my intention to go in and have a couple of angry drinks, you know, and to settle down and to chill out. But when I take a drink, the drink takes me. So they had a lot of stories to tell, and he heard them, and he said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late, and she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached about me. He just got up and told the truth as he'd experienced it through me, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Then it was my turn to testify, and I'm sitting up in the witness stand, and I'm looking out at the defense table, and he's sitting there, and that's a place where I've sat, and I could sit again, and I knew it. And it occurred to me that what stood between he and I was a drink, at least for that, for then, maybe other things, but what stood between he and I in my mind was a drink. And it occurred to me that if I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat in a very short time. And we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. And just a little tiny bit of compassion for the other alcoholic came in. And I was able to start to let the fear go, to start to let it dissipate. And it took about a year and a half for all the nightmares and all the things attendant to something like that to dissipate, but they did. And I didn't have to walk around scared, because I knew enough at the time about myself and about these inventories, that the inventory is freeing. And when I carry around those resentments and fears, it colors the way that I see you today. And that's the thing about my family, too, is that long after my family was way out of my life, I was still drinking and still mad. And they had nothing to do with the way that I, with who and where I was at the time. And so I believe in this process, in this program. And the detective who worked the case came to me, and he, after it was over, and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know. But whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it, because it seems to be working. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. And the guy got sentenced to 20 years, and he did 17. He was just released this last January 31st. As far as I know, I was notified that he was. And the same way the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous scooped in around me when this all happened 20 years ago, or 17 years ago, they were there when this was over as well. And when I heard he was getting out, they made sure that I knew I was safe until, again, I could trust the source that I can't see all the time, that I was going to be okay. And I hope that somewhere along the line he took advantage of the hospitals and institutions meetings that we take in there. You know, I've become a big fan in my sobriety of hospitals and institutions, and I get to go up to those prisons sometimes and talk to those guys. And the first time I went up to that prison, I did not want to be the one that told those guys that I testified against somebody. But my friends assured me that it would be fine, and I did. And those guys came up to me and told me I was in the safest place I could be. And I was sitting inside those prison walls in as fine a meeting as I've ever been on the outside. And some of those guys are not ever getting out, and they've found a way to be useful, to work this program, and to be useful citizens on the inside. And they walk as free as you and I do spiritually on the inside of those walls. And I have seen that, and I get humbled every time I go in. I have very little to tell them that they can't tell me and that they haven't shown me. So I don't know if this guy took advantage of that or not. I would hope that someday he would, and that he would find some peace. I wish that was the worst I think he might have been easier to forgive, or that whole situation might have been easier to forgive than the troubles that I bring on myself. And I bankrupted myself by the time I was 10 years sober. I got into a bad business deal with a boyfriend that I neither understood. It's a good idea if you are going to be in a relationship to be in the same one he's in, really. It was a couple of years after this whole rape trial thing had happened, and I thought, you know, I denied a lot of instincts, and I thought, okay, this is my chance, and I want to be like this, And somewhere along the line, too, my instincts take over. You know, those steps 6 and 7 are so powerful because my basic instincts for just making a living and putting a roof over our heads and taking care of the basic instincts, somewhere along the line, I just take over. And I go from zero to Zoom in a very hot minute. And I've always had this, I don't know if it's even been conscious, but this idea that I needed to do something brilliant and great in order to be okay, in order to have to speak for Alcoholics Anonymous in that way, or to be a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I'm finding is that it's the small kindnesses every day. It's the way that I leave somebody remembering me after I've left their presence. It's not... But back then, I was trying to get rich. I thought if I got rich, I would put on big benefits and make a lot of money for Alcoholics Anonymous and people who were hurting, and my name would be all across it. And of course not. And I ended up in bankruptcy, and I ended up having to pay a lot of money back that I did not know how I was going to pay. I didn't even know I was worth that much, and I lost all of it. And so that was the good news. And I changed home groups at 11 years sober, and I got a new sponsor. And again, I've had to start over a few times in Alcoholics Anonymous without drinking. And I want to welcome you. If you're having some trouble, start over in Alcoholics Anonymous right where you sit. And I've just done that. And had to get busy again in Alcoholics Anonymous again, and still I've got to let these things drive me in. And I want to tell you that my daughter came home to live with me during this time. And she sat me down. She and her boyfriend sat me down, and I got to tell them that they were pregnant. And and they just had that look, you know. And I got to tell her that I would be there for her no matter what she decided, and that it was all up to her, and that no matter where she was, what she decided, I was in her corner. And I got to be there, present at the birth of my first grandson, and I got to walk with her through that, and I got to help make her feel safe when she didn't feel safe, and I got to be there when she cried tears of joy and tears of sadness. And he was born, And all of this takes time. You know, we sit up here, and in about an hour, if you're new, you come in here, you hear these speaker meetings, and we sum all this up like some fancy, some little TV drama or something. It takes time. It takes time. And in the meantime, I show up at meetings, and I do my commitments, and I stick my hand out, and I try to think of somebody other than me. And all of those commitments, you know, I didn't understand the term self-centeredness. I just couldn't get my head around what that meant. Is it on me? Am I doing it now? What is it? And what I realized, it was the absence of the noise going on the inside of my own head. And that only stops when I start to listen to you. After I've taken these steps, and I live alive in 10, 11, and 12, and I'm thinking about somebody other than me, that's when the chatter on the inside of my head goes down. And sticking my hand out and trying to find out how you might be. My father doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure my name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. You know, he sleeps well, and he knows why. He doesn't understand alcoholism completely, and my sister is still out there drinking. She lost a family already, and she lives out in Wisconsin on a pig farm, and sometimes we just sit and wait for the call. You know, we just don't know. She's living a life that's so removed from where she started, and she's rarely coherent when she calls us, and we just pray for her. When I was about 5 years sober, right after this trial happened, my father was diagnosed with cancer, with prostate cancer, and I was the one he called. I was the one he called to see if I would walk through that with him, and I got to go do that, and it was an absolute privilege, an absolute privilege. And I didn't really know what to do, and what I discovered was all I had to do was really be there. And I took him that day to the day he needed to be admitted, and I was standing in at the reception area, and he was signing all his papers, and they were getting ready to take him back to the back so he could get started. And I was looking out this big bay window at the Ken Norris Cancer Center, and I looked down, and I saw the rooftops of the juvenile hall where I used to be, and he used to have to show up at court. And I thought to myself, oh, I love this view so much better than I did before. So much better. And it took time, and he always had to tell me the story about how he had to sit up nights watching the news to make sure my name wasn't on the list of the victim. You know, back then they had the Signal Hill Killer and the Hillside Strangler and the Green River Killer and all of that. And that's what it did to him. He sat in front of the TV waiting. And And when he was, I was about 12 years sober, I took him to lunch on Father's Day or his birthday or something, and we were talking, and he started to tell me the story one more time. And I thought, you know, what is the statute of limitations on having to listen to somebody tell you this story over and over? I mean, when is he going to get it? Okay, we're done. But, and I thought, you know, I've got a sharp object here in my hand. I could just stab him. And, I didn't know what else to do. How much more sorry can I be? And what else can I do? And then as he was telling this story about, he said, I have no pictures of you when you were a teenager. And I thought, oh, here we go again, something else I can't come up with. And he said, but I would trade them all away just to be able to sit here and see you in the situation that you are now. I know that you're okay. And he said, and I just love seeing that. And see, if I'd have stabbed him, I'd have missed that. So, so restraint of tongue and pen. My mom was the hardest. My mom, for whatever reason, I knew what I had done to break her heart, but it was still very difficult for a lot of years for me to stay on my side of the street. And I had to start my amends with her by acting as if. I hadn't had the complete conversion inside to be able to see where she was or completely. So that was difficult. And about 2 years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17. And she took her all weekend to die. And while she lay on life support in a Covina hospital, the whole family was in the waiting room. And I'd leave the waiting room, and I'd go out into the car, and I'd drink. And then I'd come back in, and I'd rake my mother across the coals. And I'd talk to her in a way a daughter should never talk to her mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room. And I don't know how you make amends for that. My sponsor told me to start calling her once a week and to try to find out how I might add to her life instead of take for a change. And I started to do that, and it meant to listen. It meant listening. And over time, of course, we became close. We became very close. And so much so that 8 years ago when my baby brother died of this disease, he was 6'10", 164 pounds, 30 years old when he lay on life support in a Spokane hospital. Little pinholes in his heart from doing crank, and he wasn't going to stop drinking. Mercifully, when he died, I got to go and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried yet a second child. And I don't know what kind of pain that is for a parent, really, but I know that this time, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. I lost my mom last July to end-stage liver disease, and she died a long, slow, painful death. And I continue... It's so funny how I thought, you know, I limited the amount of things that I thought I could learn from her because of the condition she was in. And I continue to learn from her even after her death. And it was, she and my third stepfather were the example of love and devotion that I had never, ever known before. And for 30 years they were together, and I got to, and she left that for me. And it was just about a month later that Doug and I got together, and we'd known each other for a very long time, and we ended up being of service out at a conference in Arizona, and for whatever reason, we got to walk into each other's lives, and we haven't walked out. And I don't think I could have seen that without having seen the example my mother left me. And I couldn't have seen the example that my mother left me without having been in Alcoholics Anonymous and doing a few simple things that you guys taught me to do. You guys taught me how to work and how to be a citizen out there in the world. And I've always had to do something physical, you know. And as a woman, I don't know if this is true for men, but I know it's true for women that as we get older, you know, things change. Things have always been changing, you know. We go into puberty, out of puberty, have kids, don't have kids, you know. And then we all know that, I'm just going to say it, you know. I don't know about you, but menopause is a big deal. And for you men, I'm pretty sure it can be for some of you too. You know, hot, cold, sweater on, sweater off, I don't know, and then the dragon lady, that's the most fun, you know. I just, getting into a relationship, I always know what my head sounds like in the morning. I've said my prayers and done my prayer meditation and all of that stuff, and then I would kind of lived alone for a long time, the better part of the 22 years I've been sober, and so I don't know what all this sounds like out loud. I just, so we've been working on that a little, But I've always had to. I've always found that doing something physical helps that edge that just nothing else can touch. And so I started out in the gym, and then I did rollerblading for a while, and I'd go out by the coast and I'd rollerblade up and down the coast and with friends, and it was just a great thing. I tried surfing for a little while, and that's where I learned. My friend Lisa says that surfing is like being in a domestically violent relationship without actually having to have a boyfriend, and I found that to be true with me. I got hurt a lot, so I was looking for the next thing to do, and I wandered in at 47 years old and 17 years sober into a ballroom dance studio, and I didn't really know what, you know, I know that my God exists because he answers questions I don't even know to ask out loud. I don't know that they need asking, and I don't know, I wouldn't know how to form the questions if I did, and I walked into this ballroom dance studio, and I didn't realize, I don't know if this happens to you guys, but sometimes I start to take myself a little too seriously. Now, I maybe not in this room, I don't know, but we... But I'm supposed to take the disease. I respect the disease. I respect the program. I take the program seriously. But myself, I shouldn't so much. And 17, man, I was into this perfectionistic thing. And perfectionism doesn't mean you're perfect. It just means you're completely obsessed with the idea of becoming so. And nobody around you feels good. My sponsees, you know, if I can't be perfect, somebody else is gonna. And so I had a little edge to me, so I'm in this dance studio, and I didn't know I'd become that stiff, and I took my little lesson, and I didn't even realize until I tried to do my first rumba lesson that I had become so stiff, and I'm with my beautiful French-Haitian teacher, and he gets about halfway through this lesson, and you know, you got to get a wiggle on to do the rumba, you just do, it's just a fact, and he slapped his forehead and said, "Oh, Carla, do not try to dance like a good girl, I don't think they will believe you anyway." It's a true story. And you know, in our book, it says that in God's hands, our dark past will become our greatest possession. And my past has been woven into a huge tapestry that is my life. It's there for those who need to see it. And yet I walk a free woman in the real world. In the real world out there, I used to make a joke and say that I now resemble someone who belongs in the outside world. But I know better than that. I know that I'm someone who actually makes a contribution out there. And I found, too, and I was reminded the other day, that the contributions don't have to be a big, big thing. I don't have to hold great benefits and make millions of dollars for those who suffer. All I have to do is some small act of kindness. Hold the door open for somebody on the way into the office. You know, listen when somebody's talking and hold my hand out when I see somebody hurting. Get some newcomer a cup of coffee. All those simple things, they add up to a lot. One of the kindest, you know, we go through sobriety, things get a little little different, and one of the best examples I ever saw, that was on an H&I commitment. I had a panel at the VA, and I took three guys from three different ages of sobriety. One guy was like 6 years sober, another man was 22 years sober, and I was about 12 or 13 years sober. And I went in, and they always brought us this big pie. These guys, they bring us this big pie and set us up with this table in front of everybody, and then they'd go sit back there. And I never knew what to do with this pie. I don't want to sit and eat pie in front of everybody. Yet they brought it to us. They've clearly given us a gift. And I would drink the coffee. So I sit, and I see the guy with 2 years sober, and he says, "What are we going to do with the pie?" And the guy with 6 years sober, he says, when they get sober 6 years, then they can have pie, you know, and that's, I thought, okay, well, I can see that too. And then the guy with 22 years, he wasn't busy asking any questions. He was up cutting the pie, handing it out to the guys in the audience. And so I learned something there. You know, I was so tied up in my head, I just wasn't sure what to do with the pie. And it's those little kindnesses, you know, those little kindnesses. And my friend Don N., who a lot of you know, I'm sure he's been up here, and he told me that he said, "You know, I was afraid when you started that dancing thing, I was afraid that you'd get all tied up in that and then leave AA. You know, people do that. They get interested in other things, and then they forget where they came from." And he said, "But what I see now," he said, "I see that the little girl who went to North Beach had to step aside so the lady who dances could come out." And he's absolutely right, you know. Howard P. always says that wherever you see God, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. And Alcoholics Anonymous was the first spot, and my family and my friends were the second. And then I found dancing. And whatever it is for you, whatever it is for you. And The dance has become my 11th, part of my 11th step. You know, it reminds me that if I'm worried about the step I'm about to take, then I'm in the future and I'm anxious. And if I'm worried about the steps that I just took, I'm into guilt and remorse and depression. And if I only pay attention to the step that I'm being led to take now, I never really know what pattern we're beginning to complete until it's done. And it's always successful. It's always the way it's supposed to be. If you're new here, I just want to remind you that this thing works. And it's a long process, but it is well worth the trip. And it all starts with the first step. Thanks for having me.